This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Kathy Wood, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Marty. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for coming. And I want to start off by complimenting you on forming an incredible team. I'm personally good friends with Yassine and David, and to see them end up at ARK has been, it's made me very happy because they're two aces in the Bitcoin space. Their analysis and everything they've done to help me better understand Bitcoin has really helped me in my trajectory in this space, and see them land at ARK and work with you has been incredible.
Oh, thank you. No, we are the blessed ones, you know, to have them. They're incredible. We have four people now working on crypto broadly, and of course, Yassine and David really leading the charge on Bitcoin. So very blessed. So smart, so humble, so passionate about the space, which is great.
And with that in mind, I think the one jumping off point I want to start this conversation is obviously you've been in the markets for quite some time. You've got a long-term view. You've seen a lot of different market cycles, a lot of different trends, particularly in tech. How does the emergence of Bitcoin and its current monetization compare to trends that you've seen in the past?
Well, it is like nothing I have seen in the past, but it is bringing everything I love together. So this idea of Bitcoin being a new, a global monetary system, that fits right into my economics. Art Laffer and I have been, he's been so excited about this since we did our first white paper in collaboration with him in 2015. He's become so excited about it that, you know, he just joined me in El Salvador to meet with President Bukele to advocate for, not only helping, he doesn't need any help on the Bitcoin side of it, but on the economic side, you get economic reform, educational reform, Bitcoin and AI, working together, converging, and you have an explosive opportunity there. So, but global monetary system, so it is that, Bitcoin, technology, the layer of the internet that really developers forgot in the early 90s because they had no idea that commerce, financial services, what have you, would take place on it. And then a new asset class, 3-in-1. There's never been anything like this.
It's been extremely exciting to be riding the Bitcoin wave over the last 11 years. And going back to El Salvador, I mean, I've thought about Bitcoin, how it's impacted my life individually. Now we're entering that territory where El Salvador leading the charge, making Bitcoin legal tender, putting it on their sovereign balance sheet. Mm-hmm. At the nation state level, honing in on El Salvador, considering the fact that you were just there, what kind of opportunities do you think Bitcoin unlocks for them specifically?
Well, I think I think that President Bukele is leading what I believe will be a movement by more enlightened leaders in emerging markets who are trying to break from the past and, the horrible cyclical and hugely cyclical booms and busts, and especially devaluations, which is a very relevant topic today. Mm-hmm. I'm shocked to see the Nigerian naira plummeting 50-60% over the last year or so. The Egyptian pound dropping 40% in March. I mean, think about how crushing that is to purchasing power and wealth of individuals. And so Bitcoin, and I know I don't have to tell this community, really is an insurance policy against what that is, which we believe it's confiscation of wealth. So I think it's becoming more and more relevant. You know, the dollar's been going up. The dollar is up a lot in the last 10, 12 years relative to most currencies. I don't think many people understand how much it is up. And that is, you know, debilitating to some of these emerging markets. And so, you know, Bitcoin couldn't come around at a better time. You know, if you have an internet connection and a smartphone, you have access to this insurance policy. And I think more and more individuals are going to take advantage of it. And the smart leaders in these countries are going to put a Bitcoin on their balance sheets because one of the devastating consequences of reserves running out is the IMF comes in and does all the wrong things. It raises tax rates. It cuts spending at a time when countries are already reeling. It's you know, a failed strategy that they, you know, it is their go-to. And I don't understand. If I were a leader in an emerging market, and I think even El Salvador is looking for funds from the IMF. But if I were a leader in an emerging market, I'd say, okay, well, you know, this really doesn't work, you know, in terms of moving countries in a healthy way out of distress. It does longer term. If you give them money and control everything, then, you know, something will happen, something will change, but not the right things. It's not a market-driven approach.
That's the literal definition of insanity. Because I ran these numbers last year, and I might be a little fuzzy on the exact details, but Argentina, as an example of this, I think between 1956 and 2023, when I did this analysis, they had 296% annualized inflation. And over that period, they had gone to the IMF for loans 21 times. Mm-hmm. So like once every 3 years, they were going to the IMF with the idea that if we do this, we'll fix our economic problems. And
then default.
Yes. It just doesn't work. But if people have this perception of the IMF as this prestigious banking institution that is going to solve problems, but historically that simply does not seem to be the case.
I'm just looking at the empirical evidence. When I know the IMF is coming in, you know, for a while, that country is going to be under a lot of duress, you know, in terms of an adjustment, the kind of a shock they administer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's for emerging markets. I mean, another thing, just global FX right now, you mentioned emerging markets, obviously Venezuela, Nigeria, we've seen Lebanon, Turkey, Egypt,
Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm. But now it's beginning to eke into the more established economies, like the yen is pushing 158 right now.
Yeah, that yen, it crossed, it got to 161 or 162 before they got serious about not just jawboning, but doing something about it. That's an interesting one because, you know, the yen has been over the years considered one of the safest currencies. But during this period when the dollar has appreciated, the yen has been cut in half relative to the dollar. We're big trading partners, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. I think it's hard for people to fathom that. And that's one of the insidious things of currency debasement is it's death by a thousand cuts, mm-hmm. frog boiling in water. You wake up one day and the Bank of Japan is having to intervene more than they'd like to.
Yeah.
To defend the peg.
Yes, that has been one of the big surprises of the year.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and they're rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com. How, I don't want to be too bombastic, but like, how imperative do you think it is for countries to think, to begin thinking seriously about diversifying their FX reserves or just a reserve assets generally towards something like Bitcoin?
Well, given what we're seeing in the private sector in the U.S. And hearing from state treasurers we're working with, the movement is already started. For example, the state of Wisconsin, I believe, has put a number of, they're not self-custodying Bitcoin or anything, but they have put some of the spot ETFs in their pension plans. And, you know, that to me speaks loudly. We're also seeing bond funds. I wouldn't think they'd be the first to embrace Bitcoin. I'd think of bonds in a different way, but they've been in a world of hurt recently because of Fed policy. And so bond managers are starting to diversify into Bitcoin. There was one very visible one, I've forgotten the name, but the 13F filings came out, and we're beginning to see, actually, it was very interesting for every manager that added gold in the last quarter, 10 added Bitcoin. So both of them through ETFs for the most part. That was illuminating. That was illuminating.
Yeah, 10 to 1 outpacing in Bitcoin's favor. And what do you think is driving that? Do you think it's people recognizing that Bitcoin is superior to gold, or do you think it's institutional investors recognizing that Bitcoin has much more potential upside compared to gold?
Well, it probably is the latter, because we're at such an early stage of institutional involvement with Bitcoin as opposed to gold. And I also think, I'd like to think that our study, as we were trying to reach institutional investors, our study basically shows that because Bitcoin has such a low correlation to other financial assets, that and because we believe it is a new asset class, that any institutional investor, now that the SEC has given, you know, this wrapper, at least the ETF, the green light to hold Bitcoin, every institution has to consider it, because it's now a matter of, okay, what's your competition doing? If when there's a new asset class that has a low correlation of returns to other assets, what that usually means is, if you add to your existing portfolio a position in Bitcoin, that over time your return per unit of risk is going to be higher than the competition. So it will become a competitive dynamic out there.
Is that where you focus it on the Sharpe ratio and just
yes,
point
yes,
that and say, hey,
yes,
look at how high this is compared to everything else?
Yes, yes. Speaking their language.
And speaking their language, in your experience at ARK and interfacing with a lot of these institutional investors, what has been the most potent pitch for Bitcoin specifically? What resonates the most with institutional investors?
That last one.
The sharper issue.
This yes, the odds of higher risk-adjusted returns for a given portfolio if you allocate a position to Bitcoin, that resonates. Mm-hmm. That resonates. I mean, in the early days, our first white paper was in 2014, the year we founded ARK. And, you know, we were facing ridicule and all kinds of it. I mean, in 10 years, the flip has been amazing. And I do think what's happening as well is what's going on in Washington. So mm-hmm. FIT 21, I'm not quite sure if that's the nickname for it, but to have 76 Democrats sign on to that, including Nancy Pelosi, it's like, what? I mean, that has awakened a lot of people to its broader acceptance instead of this kind of radicalized form of money, which is how people were thinking about it in the old days. Now, new asset class, good for our citizens, freedom, you know, lots of our values. Very interesting. It's for many people, it's, you know, this year is a one issue election. Mm-hmm. And I think that vote spoke loudly that, okay, there was this dynamic, Democrats against, Republicans for the most part. And now that's changing quickly, so quickly. And I think President Trump saying the things he said recently, but also taking campaign contributions in crypto, trying to reach the community, that's also quite significant.
It was honestly quite astonishing to see how quickly the Democratic side of the aisle turned on a dime. I think there was a lot of noise made by people in the industry, and they were like, okay, I guess we need to listen now. It's crazy to think. It's beautiful how Bitcoin halving cycles line up with election days, because yes. you have this supply inflation shock to the network every 210,000 blocks, which lines up with these election years. And you have some beautiful magic that can culminate, and I think particularly this election cycle, because 15 years in, $1.4 trillion market cap, it's impossible to ignore Bitcoin. And so
that's right.
Watching it be pushed to the fore of the conversation leading up to the presidential election is like, holy crap, how do we get here?
I guess Satoshi really understood, I mean, really understood this dynamic. I'm kidding. I'm not sure if he or it or they, you know, thought about that. But there is something called in equity markets. Actually, it's the first project I ever did when I got into the business. No, this would have been the first more economics political project I did, because the first one was about Hong Kong 1997. But was this four-year election cycle and how the equity markets trade around the election cycle. And so I pretended that the 4 years were the equivalent of 1 year, mm-hmm. and applied seasonal adjustment, the census at the time it was X11, to it to find out the seasonality. And there definitely is quote unquote seasonality around the 4 year presidential election cycle.
And does it trend in favor of one party over the other, or is it really dependent on the individual?
It has more to do with the dynamics around election. So in the fourth year, as the election is approaching, usually we have a good market, because now this one this year, I think, is not so much what I'm talking about. A lot of things are different this year, but typically the fourth year is where, you know, what the incumbent administration, which usually has the power of the purse, you know, basically throws as much at the economy and at consumer sentiment as possible, which they are trying to do, but consumer sentiment is terrible this year, but normally it's very good. And then in the first year, they really understand, okay, now we're going to have to administer the tough medicine, hope that it takes before the midterm elections, and hope that we've turned around from taking whatever tough medicine needs to be put in place. And so it depends on the party what the tough medicine is very often. That's what usually happens first year of a presidential cycle is the first and second years are a little tough. Third and fourth years are pretty good.
And yeah, you mentioned it before we hit record and alluded to it again, but this seems like an anomalous year in terms of that trend.
Yes. I mean, while technically the stock indices are up, what we're seeing is amazing concentration, record-breaking concentration. So I looked at a chart that Goldman Sachs did a month or so ago, and it showed the ratio of the market cap of the highest valued stock in the S&P 500 compared to the market cap of the stock at the 75th percentile, so the top stock in the bottom 25%. It is higher now than it's ever been. This went back before the depression of the 1900s, 1920s, and it is worse than it was back then. So what's happening? What was happening in the depression? In the depression, you know, most people were wiped out, right? Those who stayed in the stock market were, you know, they were crowding into names that they knew wouldn't go bankrupt and therefore had, you know, they had balance sheets like Fort Knox, right? And literally in the day, it probably was gold. So, and so there was huge crowding in, and we're higher now than we were back then. But the good news for us, because we've been hammered in this environment, the good news is as a market broadens out, let's say as the risks abate, and I think that will come with lower interest rates, Fed's a big problem, right? Then the broadening out of the market advantages, you know, small, mid, and, you know, the lower end of large cap stocks relative to the mega caps, because there has been so much crowding in. And I think that's going to happen this time as well. The other crowding in occurs right before we're going into a horrible bear market. So we're either going into a market that's going to broaden out and be a very good, strong market, or this is what the concentration tells us, or as in 1973 and 2000, we're going into a bear market, a bad bear market. I'm opting for the former. I think we're getting all kinds of signals that interest rates are way too high, and the headline economic numbers, the headline inflation numbers, especially when it comes to shelter and so forth, are hugely lagging. And so I think the Fed's overdoing it now. And we've seen a rolling recession, housing down, autos very weak, commercial real estate in a world of hurt, office for obvious reasons, but now multifamily because too much overbuilding. And now the consumer seems to be cracking, certainly at the edges. Low income is definitely. If you look at consumer sentiment today, it is lower for low income and middle income earners, or as low as it was in 08, 09. And the higher income consumer is now starting to capitulate in terms of sentiment. Now, I know we got... this is based on the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. Yesterday we got Conference Board, and it said confidence was up. Over the many years I've been in the business, Michigan has been the right leading indicator.
And that was down way below
target. It was shocking.
Last month.
Right? Mm-hmm. Shocking. And just one, sorry, okay. Marty. if you look at small business sentiment, so the NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, puts out a survey. I know the person who started it in the late 70s. It is as low now as it was near the lows in 08, 09. It's because small businesses cannot get funding. No. They cannot. And many bigger companies can't as well, because venture, except for AI, is basically shut.
Yeah. And you factor in other metrics to look at, like 90 plus day delinquency rates, yeah, beginning to rise to 08 levels. It's heady out there. And that's what I think that's.
And that doesn't include buy now, pay later.
No.
Which is not in any of these statistics, but has been all the rage, especially with young people.
And that, yeah, that market's grown. I mean, what was it, layaway in the 90s, 2000s, yes, but now it's been digitized.
That's right.
You can do layaway on e-com sites.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
Which is insane. And then I guess the big worry that everybody has, maybe is on Jerome Powell's mind, is stagflation. Like, if these inflationary, yeah, pressures are not tamed enough, and he lowers rates, like, does that lead us to a inflation scenario that we do not want to be in?
So I'm looking at a few leading indicators of inflation. What's interesting about this question is Art and I are disagreeing on this right now. Mm-hmm. And we have disagreed in the past. And so this is good, because I want to be kept on my own toes. So Art would say, given the monetary base unleashed during COVID, we have yet to see the inflation, cycle play out. Mm-hmm. Now, you can go back to 08, 09, and he was making that case, and you'll notice we did not go into an inflation spiral. Why not? We didn't, and this is the point we disagree on. I've always paid a lot of attention to the velocity of money, mm-hmm, the rate at which it turns over. And if you look at it over, it peaked in a secular sense in 1997. I saw a chart recently that also peaked in 1997. I'm trying to remember what it is, because I say, wow, this is the only other thing I've seen that peaked that way back then. But anyway, it's been falling, although has cyclical increases, but in a trend sense is falling, lower lows, lower highs. And so that's what happened. That velocity during the beginning of the cycle did start up, but then collapsed. And what is that? That is people saying, I'm scared, I'm not going to spend as much, I need to save a little bit more, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job. And if you look at those statistics, and there are stats on this now, the number of people making $100,000 or more who are afraid of losing their jobs now is rising dramatically. And to the point where, if you look at its correlation with the unemployment rate in the past, would put the future unemployment rate at somewhere in the 6-7% range. So if that is the environment we're in, and the velocity of money, which has had a cyclical turn up, but has not hit a new high, I think is in the process of turning down. If that turns down, and at the same time, money supply year over year is still negative, then you have one heck of a hit to GDP. Mm-hmm. So, now, Art, on the other hand, does not believe in the concept of velocity at all. He thinks it's random, a random walk, whereas I have watched it in the market be highly correlated to two things. One is optimism. So when optimism is up, that's the beginning of the cycle, mm-hmm, it will move up. When optimism is moving down, it will move down. That's what I think is happening right now. The other thing it's correlated to is inflation. If people think that inflation is going higher, and that's why we're at a very tricky point in the cycle. If people think inflation is going higher, let's say it's going to turn around from 3, 3.5 and go higher, what they will do. What's the natural thing to do? If you think interest rates and inflation are going higher, what are you going to do? You're going to buy now before those prices and interest rates go up. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think art does. So there you are. You have our, and so we can watch what happens here.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the question everybody's mind is, what is Jerome Powell thinking about this? Because that's, I think...
I don't think he thinks about that.
No?
No. No, no, no. I think he thinks about his legacy, but I think he thinks about non-farm payroll employment and the PCE core deflator. Mm-hmm. Now, I can give you some statistics that on non-farm payroll employment, we're up, I think we're up about somewhere in the 2.5% range year over year. On the household employment metric, we're flat year over year. And if you look at surveys, temporary and permanent help agencies, that world is crashing, including the wages. Wages have just taken a tumble and are well below where they were in 2019. So ARC and many other economists are looking at many other variables than just non-farm employment. And then on inflation, the inflation indicator that I've presented this to Art as well, as you can tell, I admire him greatly, and I want to debate him and understand where he's coming, because he's not in the day-to-day market. So the one I watch is the metals price index over the gold price index. So what is happening to the purchasing power of gold? And we'll do this for Bitcoin as well. But this one, you know, I've followed back into the, you know, I guess it's into the 70s. And what you see is that ratio is down at its lows in 08, 09. So the purchasing power of gold has skyrocketed relative to metals. That tells you we're in a very weak industrial world, which tends not to be inflationary. Mm-hmm. In other words, these metal prices aren't just chasing gold up. Some are up, copper has gone up, but many are not chasing gold up, or if they're moving up, not anywhere near the rate at which gold is. That tells us gold is playing a flight to safety role right now, mm-hmm. just like Bitcoin is.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores. Connect your wallets or custodial accounts and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
Fascinating to think of the inflection point that we're living through right now, because you have these inflationary pressures, you have the mechanics of the monetary systems globally where they're being debased, and then you have the censorship of assets with the West freezing Russia's treasury assets, and then last week Russia freezing Western bank assets within their country, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of back and forth happening at it that level, which
only adds to the case for Bitcoin, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. definitely. And How would you describe this current environment compared to the environments you've seen throughout your career? Is this as chaotic as a 32-year-old?
Yeah.
I was 17 when 2008 happened.
Yes.
Saw QE1, Twist, QE2, obviously COVID, European credit crisis.
Yeah.
This seems like the most chaotic time in my life.
It probably is. I don't know. If one of your family members lost your house, that probably was the most chaotic in 08-09. So if that didn't happen, then this would be. I remember when I started in my career, was the late 70s. I was in college. Art got me my first job at Capital Group. And big break. And interest rates and inflation were rising into the double digits. The dollar was plummeting. Productivity was plummeting. The U.S., and that's one thing that's not happening now, productivity is actually accelerating thanks to innovation. That is a potent anti-inflationary force, because what it does is stimulate unit growth. As prices of new technologies fall, these new technologies boom and help productivity. Of course, AI is certainly fits that bill. But back then, I remember it was a little bit like now. Of course, we're not at double digit anything in terms of inflation and interest rates. But I think we were at a tipping point back then because Chairman Volcker had come in and Ronald Reagan ultimately came in, and that and their policies brought inflation and interest rates under control and created just an incredible environment for the early days of my career, 80s and 90s. I think we're at a similar juncture now where everybody feels just so chaotic. And I remember back then saying, how are we ever going to get out of this? And, you know, I put my economics hat on as we were watching the policies evolve, Volcker, Reagan, and we saw how we were going to get out of it. I think a lot depends on this election. It makes this election, I think, very important. And what my experience is, the stock market's going to tell us who's going to win first, and maybe quite early. And I'm just saying these are the policies the stock market will reward. I am not saying anything. I'm not trying to be partisan at all. But if the market does see more free market, less regulation, more incentives for innovation and acceptance, and less regulatory backlash, even against AI now, you know, we have this executive order out there, then it will start rewarding strategies like ours. Right now, that's not happening. Right now, it is not happening. I think that's more Fed related. If we could get the Fed and perhaps an administration more friendly in terms of regulatory taxes, not raising taxes, not going to help anybody. It's not. We're talking Laffer curve territory here, right? You know, if you look at the history of taxes over time, after taxes hit 18% of GDP, and they're higher than that right now, people either bow out of the labor force and enter the gray market or just retire, work less. So, you know, raising tax rates is only going to exacerbate that. And also, as Art would say and does say almost every day, if you pay people not to work, they will not work. And that is what is happening now. And that is what has been happening. And some of it is unfortunate because of COVID. And, you know, hopefully those people were able to get on their feet with help. But, you know, we're out of the nest now. You have to be. Can't continue to incentivize, you know, lack of work.
Yeah. And it is chaotic and there's a lot of doom and gloom in the world right now. But when you think of something like AI and Bitcoin, it gets me really excited because I do believe, particularly from the Bitcoin point of view and experimenting with AI, implementing it into what we're doing here at TFTC, and it works. It makes us extremely productive. You can see that. And like, if we were allowed to just run, innovate and build, it is infinitely exciting to think about how good the world could be.
Yes.
In the next 5-10 years.
So we, and I saw Rod Rudy here, mm-hmm. From Bitcoin Park a little earlier. We did with him a podcast. It's called, we do it every month, but Bitcoin Monthly. I mean,
Brainstorm, right?
It's Bitcoin Brainstorm. We also do a Bitcoin Monthly. That's on-chain mm-hmm. analytics with our David Puel. But the Bitcoin Brainstorm. And we did it with, the Lightning Network roast beef. Mm-hmm. And he was in Africa at the time. And so we did it with Bitcoin developers who are trying to harness this idea of the convergence between Bitcoin and artificial intelligence. And he said, you know, we think we understand gig economy here in the US or the developed world. With with what they're doing with this convergence, they are redefining division of labor there mm-hmm. into micro. And we've always heard about microfinance in the emerging markets. Well, Bitcoin and AI together are enabling like super micro finance. Mm-hmm. And again, redefining division of labor in a way that we can't possibly understand here. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, the one of our portfolio companies at 1031 Stackwork, I believe Paul made a bit on that conversation, Paul Atoy. We have an immediate example of that in Guatemala, where Stackwork, Bitcoin, AI, Bitcoin working in two facets, AI working in one facet. Bitcoin and AI helped prove the Guatemalan election results, the presidential election results last fall. The incumbent party tried to say that the vote numbers were different than they actually were. And there's a company, the name's escaping me, Logan. There's a company that basically was anchoring vote data into the Bitcoin blockchain using open timestamps. Basically saying there was this many votes at this time, and if you try to say this many votes didn't happen at this time after the fact, we can actually prove cryptographically that's not the case. So that happened, and then you get in Stackwork with their army of AI bots and individuals that can do micro tasks to literally send micro tasks out to AI bots and humans alongside them to mm-hmm. validate individual election results within the span of 2 weeks, and the humans that participated in that got paid out in Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. So that right there, you literally have Bitcoin incentivizing the sanctity of data Absolutely. In this election, and then incentivizing people to validate that, and AI agents, you can incentivize them with Bitcoin now too.
Of course.
To validate that.
Absolutely.
In a beautiful way.
Oh, and that's the best example so far I've heard.
Yeah. And it's crazy to think, because the internet, when it was originally designed, it had this native payment layer.
HTTP
402.
Yes, but because no one thought, well, a couple of things. The internet was illegal for consumers to use in the U.S. in the 80s until, I think it was a telecommunications act. And so I think the vestiges of that, basically, and the desire to get this internet thing going, you know, and commercial in a way, developers just did not build in payments infrastructure. Because we had come from this illegal place. It was only for the exchange of information. And there was an AOL in the wings. And mm-hmm. that was a very quick, first big hit, to help people understand what was going on. It's interesting. In 1993, email was first connected to the internet. That was the ChatGPT moment. And mm-hmm. from then on, they ran with it. And so this payments infrastructure, and maybe you know more of the history in terms of the actual layer that they tried to put in place. But my guess is commercial desires got ahead of that, and this vestige of, wait, this is an information network, let's do this first, and they just never built it in.
Yeah, it was like you had 402, so you get the 404 error, file can't be served from the server because it's not there. And they knew that there would be a payments layer, but a combination of commercial interests, and I think there simply was not an option, a native option. We're now, like Bitcoin over the Lightning Network, you do have something that is interoperable with HTTP directly.
Well, most people remember, well, you don't remember, but I do remember in the early 90s, I mean, the internet was suffering through what Bitcoin is suffering through. Oh, it's for pornography, it's for gambling. You know, this is, we got to keep our kids away from this. I'll never put my credit card on. Are you kidding? You know, so there was a lack of trust in the internet, big time, which was all the more reason to put that payments layer in, meaning now that we know what we know, right? It's how a lot of technologies, you know, they're not derailed. They are, you know, the status quo tries to slow them down with this, hey, criminal activity and illicit activity.
Yeah. The long arch of history says that these things will get out there. They will proliferate. And on that note, talking like positive, yes. I'm trying to be more positive on this podcast, well, Kathy. The doom and gloom gets people down.
The end of that story was positive, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And combining AI and Bitcoin, I think one thing that's becoming abundantly clear is that it needs abundant amount of energy too. What are your thoughts on the intersection of the energy sector and this growing sector for compute?
Yeah, there are so many convergences taking place, and these are technology convergences taking place. One is, you know, this idea that Bitcoin can really help. Not only is more than half of it produced with renewables now, but it actually is a solution to some environmental problems, right? Exxon putting Bitcoin mining machines in its natural gas fields to basically harness, instead of flaming natural gas and venting even worse with methane, you know, harnessing that energy to mint Bitcoin. That was the first, like, finally people are getting this. We wrote a piece in conjunction with, at the time, I think it was Square, now Block, about how Bitcoin actually will be, and we are seeing this, it is happening now, will be a way to overbuild a solar and wind. So you put Bitcoin mining into a utility ecosystem where, let's say in Florida, where we relocated our company in Florida, the sun shines all the time, right? And so much so that it fills up in utilities, these huge, you know, storage units. And then what? You just waste it? No, put it into Bitcoin mining, mine the Bitcoin, and let that be your funding source for more solar and wind infrastructure. And so we see the convergence to be a win-win, actually, right?
Yeah, and I mean, we experience it firsthand down here in Texas, and particularly in West Texas, where there's a lot of solar and wind. It helps monetize those periods when electricity prices are negative and you don't want to push it to the grid because that's a cost for you, so you mine Bitcoin with it. And then it also helps out the reliable generation, like natural gas plants as well, if they're suffering from negative pricing too. It's like, hey, you put a Bitcoin mine behind the meter
and
monetize that.
It prevents it eliminates, you know, peaker plants and more peaker plants that are used, you know,
seldom
5% of the time, right? So, I mean, there are puts and takes.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin mining is going to lead us to peak energy efficiency. Most people don't understand it, but you can literally bring the market to the molecule.
Absolutely.
There's no such thing as stranded energy anymore. And it's it's insane to think about.
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, this brings us back to, again, the internet in the early days. Do you know how much electricity the internet is consuming? It's consuming as much energy as Denmark. And of course, it was the same thing with Bitcoin. This is a familiar refrain.
Mm-hmm. And it's weird too that there's been this demonization of energy. We can debate about clean energy, green energy, whatever it may be, but I think we can all agree that humans, if we were going to progress and flourish,
absolutely,
we need more energy. That's not to say we shouldn't be efficient or we should be wasteful with that energy, but we have to acknowledge as a society that we're going to need a lot more abundant, cheap energy, yes, if we want to flourish.
Well, as even a human being grows, same thing, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, it's, that's the beauty of Bitcoin too. Mm-hmm. We can shift from AI and how the Lightning Network affects AI to how's Bitcoin affecting the energy systems. Yeah. You can talk about sovereign nation balance sheets.
Yeah. And, you know, I give our team, so Yassine, David, Frank Downing is our director of research on the next generation internet, but hugely involved in crypto. And we just hired Lorenzo Valente. I mean, we have just an incredible team, and they're doing this research. When I'll tell you what one of the reasons we did the research on energy is, remember when Tesla put, or Elon put Bitcoin on Tesla's balance sheet? Mm-hmm. He did that thinking that was the right thing to do, and then he had this huge environmental backlash. And of course, Tesla, he created Tesla to quote unquote save humanity from itself in terms of electric vehicles and autonomous mobility generally. And here he has Bitcoin on his belt, and it became this big. And so he and Jack Dorsey and I and I think Steve Lee, mm-hmm, all were the first speakers at a seminar we did around this and many other topics and misperceptions about Bitcoin. It's called the B word. The B word. It's still up on our website. I think it's on YouTube too.
No, it's very important to, it's funny because you learn being involved in Bitcoin that most people don't understand money, and then they don't understand energy systems as well. So like trying to.
But what's so interesting about what you're saying, this is a big problem for all markets, especially the equity market. And we've centered our company around this idea that five major platforms are converging. These five major innovation platforms involve 14 different technologies that are converging. And so the five major platforms are robotics, energy storage, AI, blockchain technology, and multiomic sequencing in the life science space. And AI is the biggest catalyst, for the convergence, but they're all converging. They're all influencing one another in some way, shape, or form. And the way that the traditional financial world is set up, research departments, is analysts' responsibilities are organized by sector or industry, or from their point of view, even better, sub-industry. We have five consumer analysts. We have five healthcare analysts. We have five technology analysts, each one a very thin slice of each of those. But guess what? If technologies are converging, that is absolutely the wrong way to organize. So we have organized ARC's research by technology. So 14 different technologies, 14 analysts organized by technology. They are tech specialists and they are sector generalists so that they can watch as these technologies follow learning curves, which are expressed in cost declines. As costs decline and prices fall and these technologies scale across sectors, our analysts will be well positioned. Whereas these other analysts, following a very small silo, they're not going to see it coming. And they're this idea of convergence, they're not set up to embrace it even. They're not, or to understand it. So I think that's a very important distinguishing factor when it comes to ARC. You know, many people will look at our performance and say, well, hasn't helped you much, has it? And what has not helped us, what has killed all long duration assets in this market, 21, 22, and this year. Last year was great because people began to feel that interest rates were coming down. They sense we're near the peak. And now there's the opposite again. And we have this concentration issue. So I lost my train of thought. Where was I going there?
The convergence of all these sectors. If you're siloed, you're going to get blown out.
Yes, they say it hasn't done much for you. So they're quite happy to be remain organized the way they are, thinking that they're doing things the right way because this concentration strategy comes out of that organizational structure. Our structure is all about, you know, the future and how it's going to play out. So I think truth will win out and we will win out.
And you can see, I mean, I see it up close and personal just from our perspective at 1031 investing in energy companies via mining exposure, AI exposure via companies like Stackworks, Lightning Network exposure. Like, you're beginning to see these synergies like at the mining sector. Like, you can see ERCOT implementing AI to predict peak demand and the need for certain amount of power draws from certain sources at certain particular times. And then that data can be used to pass on to miners like, hey, here's when we think you're going to need to shed some load to send back to the grid. And even at the Lightning Network, creating efficiencies for channel routing when you're sending a payment through the Lightning Network, all of this can be applied. And then directly, like if you want to pay for compute up front for the AI to go ping a model, you can put a Lightning Network paywall in front of it, monetize it up front instead of waiting for a credit card fee at the end of the month.
Absolutely. I don't know if you've heard on the energy side, there's a hydroelectric plant up in upstate New York, I think it is. And I heard the story where, you know, it would love to have, you know, transmission of, you know, its power into down into New York City, but it's just not possible from an infrastructure point of view. But now with Bitcoin mining, you've got a whole new community building there. And, you know, the area is beginning to flourish, you know, because of the Bitcoin community. So it's bringing new life to, you know, rural areas that, you know, were kind of left for dead or stranded.
It's actually a reversing of Triffin's dilemma, where you flood international markets with dollars, which leads to you hollowing out your manufacturing base, and you have all this infrastructure sitting there. Substations, miners come in and say, hey, we'll buy that energy and give you some revenue.
Yep.
It's a beautiful thing to see. And I want to be cautious of your time, but before we wrap up, I mean, you made a big announcement right before you came over here. I think it's something we should touch on in terms of what you guys are doing at ARC to give back to Bitcoin, because obviously this is an open, interoperable system that is dependent on individuals maintaining it.
Yes.
And it is important for people who are leveraging Bitcoin to make sure that it is maintained. And you guys are taking a step forward to do that at ARC.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy around ARC's not coming forward with any support. What people don't know is we've been thinking about this since 2019. I had the privilege of meeting many of the core Bitcoin developers at a confab in Uruguay. And this issue came up. And, you know, I came back and I said, we've got to figure out how to figure this out. We'll do this at the right time. And then, of course, we go into COVID and, you know, all hell breaks loose both ways for us. And so then we were thinking, originally our Bitcoin ETF, the idea was that it would be priced. We thought the pricing generally in the industry would come in at about 60 basis points. But when 11 were approved at the same time, we had no choice, in any of us, but to take it down to really a place where there's no profit or very, very little profit, right? And so we recognized that. We went down to 21, and our rationale, and genuine, it's a not rationale in the bad sense. This is, wait a minute, this is a public good. So maybe it was a blessing in disguise that all 11 were approved at the same time. All the pricing is going down to 21, or I mean, there's some still at zero until X dollars or what have you. So we went to 21, we went to zero for the first billion, and then thank God hit the billion pretty quickly. But at 21, you know, when you think about all the sales and marketing and legal and infrastructure and ops, and the sales is a big one, because in our world, getting on advisor platforms is critical. And no one is on any big platform yet. There are a few small platforms that have put some ETFs on. So we basically said, okay, we were going to give a percent of profits at one price level. And we're saying, well, it would be kind of disingenuous to say, okay, we'll give a X percent of profits, when we knew there was going to be very little in the way of profits. Now, maybe that will change over time, you know, as we see more efficiencies, but so far, you know, as it stood. And so we thought, we have to think of something different. So we took our time, and I'm not going to divulge everything, and I didn't this morning either, because we want to reserve that for a Bitcoin park. We do the Bitcoin brainstorm with them every month, and I think that in July this might happen. But we have private funds, private crypto funds. And so we have, some people in the community, very, very few know this, but we are going to give a percentage of our revenues, not profits. We're not going to play that game, to core Bitcoin developers. And we'll give more of the details in July. But and we always knew we were going to do it, and all of the drama that took place was, first of all, I kind of didn't know about it because other markets were calling for my attention. But Yassine did call my attention to it. And so,
it's awesome
to
see. And I think, having followed the work that you've been putting out at ARK over the last decade, it's, I think, particularly in the position that you stand in, interfacing with institutional investors, I think you guys have done an incredible job of highlighting what the opportunity that stands before us and how it works in the first place. And again, I think this step by ARK to contribute to core developers is just a continuation of the lead that you guys have had in terms of understanding and really being on top of what's happening in the space. So.
And really wanting to become in some way a part of the community. And the community has welcomed us so warmly, you know, the drama kind of, you know, energized everybody a bit more, but, but I think we're all good.
Yeah, we're all good. The drama is, it gets tiresome sometimes.
It comes with the territory. It's true in everything we do. It's just innovation. When disruptive innovation, disturbing the traditional world order, there's always a lot of drama. Why? Because the old guard basically is treating us in the early days like fleas. Get out of here. You know, you don't belong here. And I'm talking about the traditional financial world vis-a-vis Bitcoin. But it's true, the traditional financial world versus what we are doing at ARK right now. You know, people think we're crazy for actually investing in companies that aren't in the broad-based benchmarks. Our entire portfolio practically is made up of those, and they think that's nuts. I started in a world in 1977 when I was in college at Capital Group. No one used a benchmark as his or her guide. They had a clean sheet of paper, and they didn't have computers at the time, but they thought there was critical thinking, original research, a lot of hard work, and trying to figure out how the world is going to work. That's what we're doing. And hopefully the pendulum, which has been to passive and which has nourished these broad benchmarks for years and years and years now, 20 years, hopefully that pendulum is going to swing, and that this massive concentration towards just a few stocks is going to end, because you know that is not good for innovation.
No, concentration is never good. And I think the success of the launch of the ETFs is a validation of what you just said, is like people are looking for something to diversify away from that concentration.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, our strategies, all of them, including the spot Bitcoin ETF, which is, I should have mentioned, is in partnership with 21 Shares. All of our strategies, all of the active equity ETFs are diversifiers against what has happened in the last 20 years. You know, this I often say worshiping at the altar of the almighty indexes. You know, that's a thing that has happened. But, you know, with real research and hard work and an eye to the future, we think ultimately we're in a winning position.
Well, Kathy, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us here in the Commons.
Oh, thank you, Marty. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Can we send anybody listening anywhere to find out more information about ARK, your research, the spot ETF?
Sure. Well, we have... We do two monthlies for the Bitcoin, for investors interested in Bitcoin. One is the Bitcoin Monthly. David Puel authors that, and that's all on-chain analytics. And you know, we basically rate them as bullish, neutral, or bearish, and how they've trended over the last month. So it's a good way. It's a nice way to get to know the internal dynamics, the health of the ecosystem, and so forth. Then we have Bitcoin Brainstorm with Bitcoin Park, which is monthly as well. And there we invite the people who are doing the hard work behind the scenes. You mentioned, I think our last one was on miners, behind the scenes, and you know what they are seeing, thinking, worrying about. You know, it's a really, really good confidence enhancer for anyone who doesn't understand, you know, all of the moving parts here and all of the people involved, all of the puts and takes and so forth. And then, yes, we have white papers there on our site, ark-invest.com, as well as blogs. And, you know, we also put out something called The Brainstorm weekly, and very often on our Friday brainstorm, we will have featured Bitcoin, and so you'll often, Yassine and the team, David and others, are often on the brainstorm. So we give our research away because we think these, first of all, this movement is so important, but these the area of disruptive innovation broadly is so inefficiently priced in the market because it's not well understood. The companies that are going to move and shake the world going forward are not in the broad-based benchmarks. If they're not in the broad-based benchmarks, then traditional analysts don't want to follow them. Those are exactly the kinds of names we want to follow, because they're probably the sleepers and are going to create some surprising results longer term.
Yeah. I'm bullish.
I'm bullish.
I entered this, I'm leaving this conversation more bullish than I entered. Kathy, again, Yay. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
I am sure I will. I love Austin, and it is a beautiful day out there.
You're lucky it's not Sunday when it was 115. We got good weather today.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It is. Peace and love, freaks. Tiki!